His eyes were sad and kind of empty, as if he'd stared into the depths of Tartarus, which he had. The only absent demigod was Piper, who was taking her turn at the helm with Coach Hedge, their satyr chaperone.
Leo wished Piper were here.
She had a way of calming things down with that Aphrodite charm of hers. After his dreams last night, Leo could use some calm. On the other hand, it was probably good she was above deck chaperoning their chaperone. Now that they were in the ancient lands, they had to be constantly on guard. Leo was nervous about letting Coach Hedge fly solo. The satyr was a little trigger-happy, and the helm had plenty of bright, dangerous buttons that could cause the picturesque Italian villages below them to go boom. Leo had zoned out so totally he didn't realize Jason was still talking. "The House of Hades," he was saying. "Nico?" Nico sat forward.
"I communed with the dead last night."
He just tossed that line out there, like he was saying he got a text from a buddy.
"I was able to learn more about what we'll face," Nico continued. "In ancient times, the House of Hades was a major site for Greek pilgrims. They would come to speak with the dead and honor their ancestors."
Leo frowned.
"Sounds like Dia de los Muertos. My Aunt Rosa took that stuff seriously."
He remembered being dragged by her to the local cemetery in Houston, where they'd clean up their relatives' grave sites and put out offerings of lemonade, cookies, and fresh marigolds. Aunt Rosa would force Leo to stay for a picnic, as if hanging out with dead people were good for his appetite. Frank grunted.
"Chinese have that too. Ancestor worship. Sweeping the graves in the springtime."
He glanced at Leo.
"Your Aunt Rosa would have gotten along with my grandmother."
Leo had a terrifying image of his Aunt Rosa and some old Chinese woman in wrestler's outfits, wailing on each other with spiked clubs.
"Yeah," Leo said. "I'm sure they would have been best buds."
Nico cleared his throat.
"A lot of cultures have seasonal traditions to honor the dead, but the House of Hades was open year-round. Pilgrims could actually speak to the ghosts. In Greek, the place was called the Necromantion, the Oracle of Death. You'd work your way through different levels of tunnels, leaving offerings and drinking special potions."
"Special potions?" Leo muttered. "Yum." Jason flashed him a look like,
"Dude, enough.
Nico, go on."
"The pilgrims believed that each level of the temple brought you closer to the underworld until the dead would appear before you. If they were pleased with your offerings, they would answer your questions, maybe even tell you the future."
Frank tapped his mug of hot chocolate.
"And if the spirits weren't pleased?"
"Some pilgrims found nothing," Nico said. "Some went insane or died after leaving the temple. Others lost their way in the tunnels and were never seen again."
"The point is," Jason said quickly, "Nico found some information that might help us."
"Yeah."
Nico didn't sound very enthusiastic.
"The ghost I spoke to last night, he was a former priest of Hecate. He confirmed what the goddess told Hazel yesterday at the crossroads. In the first war with the giants, Hecate fought for the gods. She slew one of the giants, one who'd been designed as the anti-Hecate. A guy named Clytius."
"Dark dude," Leo guessed. "Wrapped in shadows." Hazel turned toward him, her gold eyes narrowing.
"Leo, how did you know that?"
"Kind of had a dream." No one looked surprised. Most demigods had vivid nightmares about what was going on in the world. His friends paid close attention as Leo explained. He tried not to look at the wall images of Camp Half-Blood as he described the place in ruins. He told them about the dark giant and the strange woman on Half-Blood Hill, offering him a multiple-choice death. Jason pushed away his plate of pancakes.
So the giant is Clytius. I suppose he'll be waiting for us, guarding the doors of death.
Frank rolled up one of the pancakes and started munching. Not a guy to let impending death stand in the way of a healthy breakfast.
And the woman in Leo's dream?
She's my problem.
Hazel passed a diamond between her fingers and a sleight of hand.
Hecate mentioned a formidable enemy in the House of Hades, a witch who couldn't be defeated except by me, using magic.
Do you know magic?
Leo asked.
Not yet.
Ah.
He tried to think of something hopeful to say, but he recalled the angry woman's eyes, the way her steely grip made his skin smoke.
Any idea who she is?
Hazel shook her head.
Only that...
She glanced at Nico, and some sort of silent argument happened between them. Leo got the feeling that the two of them had had some private conversations about the House of Hades, and they weren't sharing all the details.
Only that she won't be easy to defeat.
But there is some good news, Nico said. The ghost I talked to explained how Hecate defeated Clytius in the first war. She used her torches to set his hair on fire. He burned to death. In other words, fire is his weakness.
Everybody looked at Leo.
Oh,
he said.
Okay.
Jason nodded encouragingly, like this was great news. Like he expected Leo to walk up to a towering mass of darkness, shoot a few fireballs, and solve all their problems. Leo didn't want to bring him down, but he could still hear Gia's voice.
He is the void that consumes all magic, the cold that consumes all fire, the silence that consumes all speech.
Leo was pretty sure it would take more than a few matches to set that giant ablaze.
It's a good lead, Jason insisted. At least we know how to kill the giant. And this sorceress, well, if Hecate believes Hazel can defeat her, then so do I.
Hazel dropped her eyes.
Now we just have to reach the House of Hades, battle our way through Gia's forces.
Plus a bunch of ghosts. Nico added grimly. The spirits in that temple may not be friendly.
And find the doors of death,
Hazel continued.
Assuming we can somehow arrive at the same time as Percy and Annabeth and rescue them.
Frank swallowed a bite of pancake.
We can do it. We have to.
Leo admired the big guy's optimism. He wished he shared it.
So, with this detour, Leo said, I'm estimating 4 or 5 days to arrive at Epirus, assuming no delays for, you know, monster attacks and stuff.
Jason smiled sourly. Yeah, those never happen. Leo looked at Hazel.
Hecate told you that Gia was planning her big wake-up party on August 1st, right? The feast of whatever?
Spes, Hazel said, the goddess of hope. Jason turned his fork.
Theoretically, that leaves us enough time. It's only July 5th. We should be able to close the doors of death, then find the giant's HQ and stop them from waking Gia before August 1st.
Theoretically, Hazel agreed. But I'd still like to know how we make our way through the House of Hades without going insane or dying.
Nobody volunteered any ideas. Frank set down his pancake roll like it suddenly didn't taste so good.
It's July 5th. Oh, jeez. I hadn't even thought of that.
Hey, man, it's cool,
Leo said.
You're Canadian, right? I didn't expect you to get me an Independence Day present or anything. Unless you wanted to.
It's not that. My grandmother, she always told me that 7 was an unlucky number. It was a ghost number. She didn't like it when I told her there would be 7 demigods on our quest. And July is the 7th month.
Yeah, but...
Leo tapped his fingers nervously on the table. He realized he was doing the Morse code for I love you, the way he used to do with his mom, which would have been pretty embarrassing if his friends understood Morse code.
But that's just coincidence, right?
Frank's expression didn't reassure him.
Back in China, Frank said, in the old days, people called the 7th month the ghost month. That's when the spirit world and the human world were closest. The living and the dead could go back and forth. Tell me it's a coincidence we're searching for the doors of death during the ghost month.
No one spoke.
Leo wanted to think that an old Chinese belief couldn't have anything to do with the Romans and the Greeks. Totally different, right? But Frank's existence was proof that the cultures were tied together. The Zhang family went all the way back to ancient Greece. They'd found their way through Rome and China, and finally to Canada. Also, Leo kept thinking about his meeting with the revenge goddess Nemesis at the Great Salt Lake. Nemesis had called him the 7th wheel, the odd man out on the quest. She didn't mean 7th as in ghost, did she? Jason pressed his hands against the arms of his chair.
Let's focus on the things we can deal with. We're getting close to Bologna. Maybe we'll get more answers once we find these dwarfs that Hecate...
The ship lurched, as if it had hit an iceberg. Leo's breakfast plate slid across the table.
Nico fell backward out of his chair and banged his head against the sideboard. He collapsed on the floor, with a dozen magic goblets and platters crashing down on top of him.
Nico!
Hazel ran to help him.
What?
Frank tried to stand, but the ship pitched in the other direction. He stumbled into the table and went face first into Leo's plate of scrambled eggs.
Look!
Jason pointed at the walls. The images of Camp Half-Blood were flickering and changing.
Not possible, Leo murmured.
No way those enchantments could show anything other than scenes from camp. But suddenly, a huge, distorted face filled the entire port side wall. Crooked yellow teeth, a scraggly red beard, a warty nose, and 2 mismatched eyes, one much larger and higher than the other. The face seemed to be trying to eat its way into the room. The other walls flickered, showing scenes from above deck. Piper stood at the helm, but something was wrong. From the shoulders down, she was wrapped in duct tape. Her mouth gagged and her legs bound to the control console. At the mainmast, Coach Hedge was similarly bound and gagged, while a bizarre-looking creature, a sort of gnome-chimpanzee combo with poor fashion sense, danced around him, doing the coach's hair in tiny pigtails with pink rubber bands. On the port side wall, the huge, ugly face receded so that Leo could see the entire creature. Another gnome chimp in even crazier clothes. This one began leaping around the deck, stuffing things in a burlap bag, Piper's dagger, Leo's Wii controllers. Then he pried the Archimedes sphere out of the command console.
No!
Leo yelled.
Ugh!
Nico groaned from the floor.
Piper!
Jason cried.
Monkey!
Frank yelled.
Not monkeys, Hazel grumbled. I think those are dwarfs.
Stealing my stuff!
Leo yelled, and he ran for the stairs. Chapter 11. Leo. Leo was vaguely aware of Hazel shouting,
Go! I'll take care of Nico!
As if Leo was going to turn back. Sure, he hoped D'Angelo was okay, but he had headaches of his own. Leo bounded up the steps, with Jason and Frank behind him. The situation on deck was even worse than he feared. Coach Hedge and Piper were struggling against their duct tape bonds while one of the demon monkey dwarfs danced around the deck, picking up whatever wasn't tied down and sticking it in his bag. He was maybe 4 feet tall, even shorter than Coach Hedge, with bowed legs and chimp-like feet. His clothes so loud they gave Leo vertigo. His green plaid pants were pinned at the cuffs and held up with bright red suspenders over a striped pink and black woman's blouse. He wore half a dozen gold watches on each arm and a zebra-patterned cowboy hat with a price tag dangling from the brim. His skin was covered with patches of scraggly red fur, though 90% of his body hair seemed to be concentrated in his magnificent eyebrows. Leo was just forming the thought, "Where's the other dwarf?" when he heard a click behind him and realized he'd led his friends into a trap. "Duck!" He hit the deck as the explosion blasted his eardrums. "Note to self," Leo thought groggily. "Do not leave boxes of magic grenades where dwarfs can reach them." At least he was alive. Leo had been experimenting with all sorts of weapons based on the Archimedes sphere that he'd recovered in Rome. He'd built grenades that could spray acid, fire, shrapnel, or freshly buttered popcorn. Hey, you never knew when you'd get hungry in battle. Judging from the ringing in Leo's ears, the dwarf had detonated the flashbang grenade, which Leo had filled with a rare vial of Apollo's music, pure liquid extract. It didn't kill, but it left Leo feeling like he'd just done a belly flop off the deep end. He tried to get up. His limbs were useless. Someone was tugging at his waist. Maybe a friend trying to help him up? No. His friends didn't smell like heavily perfumed monkey cages. He managed to turn over. His vision was out of focus and tinted pink, like the world had been submerged in strawberry jelly. A grinning, grotesque face loomed over him. The brown-furred dwarf was dressed even worse than his friend, in a green bowler hat like a leprechaun's, dangly diamond earrings, and a white and black referee's shirt. He showed off the prize he'd just stolen, Leo's tool belt, then danced away. Leo tried to grab him, but his fingers were numb. The dwarf frolicked over to the nearest ballista, which his red-furred friend was priming to launch. The brown-furred dwarf jumped onto the projectile like it was a skateboard, and his friend shot him into the sky. Red Fur pranced over to Coach Hedge. He gave the satyr a big smack on the cheek, then skipped to the rail. He bowed to Leo, doffing his zebra cowboy hat, and did a backflip over the side. Leo managed to get up. Jason was already on his feet, stumbling and running into things. Frank had turned into a silverback gorilla. Why? Leo wasn't sure. Maybe to commune with the monkey dwarfs? But the flash grenade had hit him hard. He was sprawled on the deck, with his tongue hanging out, and his gorilla eyes rolled up in his head. "Piper!" Jason staggered to the helm and carefully pulled the gag out of her mouth. "Don't waste your time on me," she said. "Go after them!" At the mast, Coach Hedge mumbled, Leo figured that meant, "Kill them!" Easy translation, since most of the coach's sentences involved the word kill. Leo glanced at the control console. His Archimedes sphere was gone. He put his hand to his waist where his tool belt should have been. His head started to clear, and his sense of outrage came to a boil. Those dwarfs had attacked his ship. They'd stolen his most precious possessions. Below him spread the city of Bologna, a jigsaw puzzle of red-tiled buildings in a valley hemmed by green hills. Unless Leo could find the dwarves somewhere in that maze of streets. Nope. Failure wasn't an option. Neither was waiting for his friends to recover. He turned to Jason.
You feeling good enough to control the winds? I need a lift.
Jason frowned.
Sure, but...
Good, Leo said.
We've got some monkey dudes to catch.
Jason and Leo touched down in a big piazza lined with white marble government buildings and outdoor cafes. Bikes and Vespas clogged the surrounding streets, but the square itself was empty except for pigeons and a few old men drinking espresso. None of the locals seemed to notice the huge Greek warship hovering over the piazza, or the fact that Jason and Leo had just flown down, Jason wielding a gold sword, and Leo, well, Leo pretty much empty-handed.
Where to? Jason asked.
Leo stared at him.
Well, I don't know. Let me pull my dwarf tracking GPS out of my tool belt. Oh, wait. I don't have a dwarf tracking GPS. Or my tool belt.
Fine, Jason grumbled. He glanced up at the ship as if to get his bearings, then pointed across the piazza. The ballista fired the first dwarf in that direction, I think. Come on. They waded through a lake of pigeons, then maneuvered down a side street of clothing stores and gelato shops. The sidewalks were lined with white columns covered in graffiti. A few panhandlers asked for change. Leo didn't know Italian, but he got the message loud and clear. He kept patting his waist, hoping his tool belt would magically reappear. It didn't. He tried not to freak, but he'd come to depend on that belt for almost everything. He felt like somebody had stolen one of his hands.
We'll find it, Jason promised.
Usually, Leo would have felt reassured. Jason had a talent for staying level-headed in a crisis, and he'd gotten Leo out of plenty of bad scrapes. Today, though, all Leo could think about was the stupid fortune cookie he had opened in Rome. The goddess Nemesis had promised him help, and he'd gotten it. The code to activate the Archimedes sphere. At the time, Leo had had no choice but to use it if he wanted to save his friends. But Nemesis had warned that her help came with a price. Leo wondered if that price would ever be paid. Percy and Annabeth were gone. The ship was hundreds of miles off course, heading toward an impossible challenge. Leo's friends were counting on him to beat a terrifying giant. And now, he didn't even have his tool belt or his Archimedes sphere. He was so absorbed with feeling sorry for himself that he didn't notice where they were until Jason grabbed his arm.
Check it out.
Leo looked up. They'd arrived in a smaller piazza. Looming over them was a huge bronze statue of a buck-naked Neptune.
Ah, jeez!
Leo averted his eyes. He really didn't need to see a godly groin this early in the morning. The sea god stood on a big marble column in the middle of a fountain that wasn't working, which seemed kind of ironic. On either side of Neptune, little winged Cupid dudes were sitting, kind of chillin', like, what's up? Neptune himself, avoid the groin, was throwing his hip to one side in an Elvis Presley move. He gripped his trident loosely in his right hand and stretched his left hand out, like he was blessing Leo, or possibly attempting to levitate him.
Some kind of clue?
Leo wondered. Jason frowned.
Maybe, maybe not.
There are statues of the gods all over the place in Italy. I'd just feel better if we ran across Jupiter or Minerva. Anybody but Neptune, really. Leo climbed into the dry fountain. He put his hand on the statue's pedestal, and a rush of impressions surged through his fingertips. He sensed celestial bronze gears, magical levers, springs, and pistons.
"It's mechanical," he said. "Maybe a doorway to the dwarves' secret lair?"
"Oh!" shrieked a nearby voice. "Secret lair! I want a secret lair!"
yelled another voice from above. Jason stepped back, his sword ready. Leo almost got whiplash trying to look in two places at once. The red-furred dwarf in the cowboy hat was sitting about 30 feet away at the nearest cafe table, sipping an espresso with his monkey-like foot. The brown-furred dwarf in the green bowler was perched on the marble pedestal at Neptune's feet, just above Leo's head.
"If we had a secret lair," said Redfur, "I would want a firehouse pole." "And a water slide," said Brownfur, who was pulling random tools out of Leo's belt, tossing aside wrenches, hammers, and staple guns.
"Stop that!"
Leo tried to grab the dwarf's feet, but he couldn't reach the top of the pedestal.
"Too short?"
Brownfur sympathized.
"You're calling me short?"
Leo looked around for something to throw, but there was nothing but pigeons, and he doubted he could catch one.
"Give me my belt, you stupid—"
Now, said Brownfur. "We haven't even introduced ourselves. I'm Akmon, and my brother over there is the handsome one."
The red-furred dwarf lifted his espresso. Judging from his dilated eyes and his maniacal grin, he didn't need any more caffeine.
"Passalos, singer of songs, drinker of coffee, stealer of shiny stuff."
"Please,"
shrieked his brother Akmon.
"I steal much better than you."
Passalos snorted.
"Stealing naps, maybe."
He took out a knife, Piper's knife, and started picking his teeth with it.
"Hey," Jason yelled, "that's my girlfriend's knife."
He lunged at Passalos, but the red-furred dwarf was too quick. He sprang from his chair, bounced off Jason's head, did a flip, and landed next to Leo, his hairy arms around Leo's waist.
"Save me?"
the dwarf pleaded.
"Get off!"
Leo tried to shove him away, but Passalos did a backward somersault and landed out of reach. Leo's pants promptly fell around his knees. He stared at Passalos, who was now grinning and holding a small zigzaggy strip of metal. Somehow, the dwarf had stolen the zipper right off Leo's pants.
"Give, stupid zipper!"
Leo stuttered, trying to shake his fist and hoist up his pants at the same time.
"Eh, not shiny enough."
Passalos tossed it away. Jason lunged with his sword. Passalos launched himself straight up and was suddenly sitting on the statue's pedestal next to his brother.
"Tell me I don't have moves,"
Passalos boasted.
"Okay,"
Akmon said.
"You don't have moves."
"Bah!"
Passalos said.
"Give me the tool belt. I want to see."
"No."
Akmon elbowed him away.
"You got the knife and the shiny ball."
"Yes, the shiny ball is nice."
Passalos took off his cowboy hat. Like a magician producing a rabbit, he pulled out the Archimedes sphere and began tinkering with the ancient bronze dials.
"Stop!"
Leo yelled.
"That's a delicate machine."
Jason came to his side and glared up at the dwarves.
"Who are you two, anyway?"
"The Kirkopis."
Akmon narrowed his eyes at Jason.
"I bet you're a son of Jupiter, eh? I can always tell."
"Just like Black Bottom,"
Passalos agreed.
"Black Bottom?"
Leo resisted the urge to jump at the dwarf's feet again. He was sure Passalos was going to ruin the Archimedes sphere any second now.
"Yes, you know,"
Akmon grinned.
"Hercules. We called him Black Bottom because he used to go around without clothes.
He got so tan that his backside... Well,
at least he had a sense of humor, Pasalos said. He was going to kill us when we stole from him, but he let us go because he liked our jokes. Not like you two, grumpy, grumpy.
Hey, I've got a sense of humor, Leo snarled. Give me back our stuff, and I'll tell you a joke with a good punchline.
Nice try.
Akmon pulled a ratchet wrench from the tool belt and spun it like a noisemaker.
Oh, very nice. I'm definitely keeping this. Thanks, Blue Bottom.
Blue Bottom? Leo glanced down. His pants had slipped around his ankles again, revealing his blue undershorts.
That's it, he shouted. My stuff, now, or I'll show you how funny a flaming dwarf is.
His hands caught fire.
Now we're talking.
Jason thrust his sword into the sky. Dark clouds began to gather over the piazza. Thunder boomed.
Oh, scary!
Akmon shrieked.
Yes, Pasalos agreed. If only we had a secret lair to hide in. Alas, this statue isn't the doorway to a secret lair, Akmon said. It has a different purpose.
Leo's gut twisted. The fires died in his hands, and he realized something was very wrong. He yelled,
Trap!
And dove out of the fountain. Unfortunately, Jason was too busy summoning his storm. Leo rolled on his back as 5 golden cords shot from the Neptune statue's fingers. One barely missed Leo's feet. The rest homed in on Jason, wrapping him like a rodeo calf and yanking him upside down. A bolt of lightning blasted the tines of Neptune's trident, sending arcs of electricity up and down the statue. But the Kirkopes had already disappeared.
Bravo!
Akmon applauded from a nearby cafe table.
You make a wonderful piñata, son of Jupiter.
Yes,
Pasalos agreed.
Hercules hung us upside down once, you know. Oh, revenge is sweet.
Leo summoned a fireball. He lobbed it at Pasalos, who was trying to juggle 2 pigeons and the Archimedes sphere.
Eek!
The dwarf jumped free of the explosion, dropping the sphere and letting the pigeons fly.
Time to leave, Akmon decided.
He tipped his bowler and sprang away, jumping from table to table. Pasalos glanced at the Archimedes sphere, which had rolled between Leo's feet. Leo summoned another fireball.
Try me,
he snarled.
Bye!
Pasalos did a backflip and ran after his brother. Leo scooped up the Archimedes sphere and ran over to Jason, who was still hanging upside down, thoroughly hogtied except for his sword arm. He was trying to cut the cords with his gold blade, but having no luck.
Hold on, Leo said. If I can find a release switch...
Just go,
Jason growled.
I'll follow you when I get out of this.
But
don't lose them.
The last thing Leo wanted was some alone time with the monkey dwarfs, but the Kirkopes were already disappearing around the far corner of the piazza. Leo left Jason hanging and ran after them. Chapter 12. Leo. The dwarves didn't try very hard to lose him, which made Leo suspicious. They stayed just at the edge of his vision, scampering over red-tiled rooftops, knocking over window boxes, whooping and hollering and leaving a trail of screws and nails from Leo's tool belt. Almost as if they wanted Leo to follow. He jogged after them, cursing every time his pants fell down. He turned a corner and saw 2 ancient stone towers jutting into the sky, side by side, much taller than anything else in the neighborhood. Maybe medieval watchtowers? They leaned in different directions like gear shifts on a race car. The Kirkopes scaled the tower on the right. When they reached the top, they climbed around the backside and disappeared, Had they gone inside? Leo could see some tiny windows at the top, covered with metal grates, but he doubted those would stop the dwarfs. He watched for a minute, but the Kirkopis didn't reappear, which meant Leo had to get up there and look for them.
Great, he muttered.
No flying friend to carry him up. The ship was too far away to call for help. He could jury-rig the Archimedes sphere into some sort of flying device, maybe, but only if he had his tool belt, which he didn't. He scanned the neighborhood, trying to think. Half a block down, a set of double glass doors opened, and an old lady hobbled out, carrying plastic shopping bags. A grocery store? Leo patted his pockets. To his amazement, he still had some euro notes from his time in Rome. Those stupid dwarfs had taken everything except his money. He ran for the store as fast as his zipperless pants allowed. Leo scoured the aisles, looking for things he could use. He didn't know the Italian for, "Hello, where are your dangerous chemicals, please?" But that was probably just as well. He didn't want to end up in an Italian jail. Fortunately, he didn't need to read labels. He could tell just from picking up a toothpaste tube whether it contained potassium nitrate. He found charcoal. He found sugar and baking soda. The store sold matches and bug spray and aluminum foil. Pretty much everything he needed. Plus a laundry cord he could use as a belt. He added some Italian junk food to the basket, just to sort of disguise his more suspicious purchases, then dumped his stuff at the register. A wide-eyed checkout lady asked him some questions he didn't understand, but he managed to pay, get a bag, and race out. He ducked into the nearest doorway where he could keep an eye on the towers. He started to work, summoning fire to dry out materials and do a little cooking that otherwise would have taken days to complete. Every once in a while, he sneaked a look at the tower, but there was no sign of the dwarfs. Leo could only hope they were still up there. Making his arsenal took just a few minutes. He was that good. But it felt like hours. Jason didn't show. Maybe he was still tangled at the Neptune Fountain, or scouring the streets looking for Leo. No one else from the ship came to help. Probably it was taking them a long time to get all those pink rubber bands out of Coach Hedge's hair. That meant Leo had only himself, his bag of junk food, and a few highly improvised weapons made from sugar and toothpaste. Oh, and the Archimedes sphere. That was kind of important. He hoped he hadn't ruined it by filling it with chemical powder. He ran to the tower and found the entrance. He started up the winding stairs inside, only to be stopped at a ticket booth by some caretaker who yelled at him in Italian. "Seriously?" Leo asked. "Look, man, you've got dwarves in your belfry. I'm the exterminator." He held up his can of bug spray. "See? Exterminator. Molto buono. Squirt, squirt. Ah!" He pantomimed a dwarf melting in terror, which for some reason the Italian didn't seem to understand. The guy just held out his palm for money.
"Dang, man," Leo grumbled. "I just spent all my cash on homemade explosives and whatnot."
He dug around in his grocery bag.
"Don't suppose you'd accept, whatever these are?"
Leo held up a yellow and red bag of junk food called Fonzie's. He assumed they were some kind of chips. To his surprise, the caretaker shrugged and took the bag.
"Avanti!"
Leo kept climbing, but he made a mental note to stock up on Fonzie's. Apparently, they were better than cash in Italy. The stairs went on and on and on. The whole tower seemed to be nothing but an excuse to build a staircase. He stopped on a landing and slumped against a narrow barred window, trying to catch his breath. He was sweating like crazy, and his heart thumped against his ribs. Stupid Kirkopis. Leo figured that as soon as he reached the top, they would jump away before he could use his weapons. But he had to try. He kept climbing. Finally, his legs feeling like overcooked noodles, he reached the summit. The room was about the size of a broom closet, with barred windows on all four walls. Shoved in the corners were sacks of treasure, shiny goodies spilling all over the floor. Leo spotted Piper's knife, an old leather-bound book, a few interesting-looking mechanical devices, and enough gold to give Hazel's horse a stomachache. At first, he thought the dwarves had left. Then he looked up. Akmon and Pasilos were hanging upside down from the rafters by their chimp feet, playing anti-gravity poker. When they saw Leo, they threw their cards like confetti and broke out in applause.
"I told you he'd do it!" Akmon shrieked in delight.
Pasilo shrugged and took off one of his gold watches and handed it to his brother.
"You win! I didn't think he was that dumb."
They both dropped to the floor. Akmon was wearing Leo's tool belt. So close. Leo had to resist the urge to lunge for it. Pasilo straightened his cowboy hat and kicked open the grate on the nearest window.
"What should we make him climb next, brother? The Dome of San Luca?"
Leo wanted to throttle the dwarfs, but he forced a smile.
"Oh, that sounds fun. But before you guys go, you forgot something shiny."
"Impossible!"
Akmon scowled.
"We were very thorough."
"You sure?"
Leo held up his grocery bag. The dwarfs inched closer. As Leo had hoped, their curiosity was so strong that they couldn't resist.
"Look."
Leo brought out his first weapon, a lump of dried chemicals wrapped in aluminum foil, and lit it with his hand. He knew enough to turn away when it popped, but the dwarves were staring right at it. Toothpaste, sugar, and bug spray weren't as good as Apollo's music, but they made for a pretty decent flashbang. The Kirkopis wailed, clawing at their eyes. They stumbled toward the window, but Leo set off his homemade firecrackers, snapping them around the dwarf's bare feet to keep them off balance. Then, for good measure, Leo turned the dial on his Archimedes sphere, which unleashed a plume of foul white fog that filled the room. Leo wasn't bothered by smoke. Being immune to fire, he'd stood in smoky bonfires, endured dragon breath, and cleaned out blazing forges plenty of times. While the dwarfs were hacking and wheezing, he grabbed his tool belt from Akmon, calmly summoned some bungee cords, and tied up the dwarfs.
"My eyes!"
Akmon coughed.
"My tool belt! My feet are on fire!"
Pasilos wailed.
"Not shiny! Not shiny at all!"
After making sure they were securely bound, Leo dragged the Kirkopis into one corner and began rifling through their treasures. He retrieved Piper's dagger, a few of his prototype grenades, and a dozen other odds and ends the dwarves had taken from the Argo II.
"Please!" Akmon wailed. "Don't take our shinies!"
"We'll make you a deal,"
Pasilos suggested.
"We'll cut you in for 10% if you let us go."
Afraid not,
Leo muttered.
"It's all mine now."
20%!
Just then, thunder boomed overhead. Lightning flashed, and the bars on the nearest window burst into sizzling, melted stubs of iron. Jason flew in like Peter Pan, electricity sparking around him and his gold sword steaming. Leo whistled appreciatively.
"Man, you just wasted an awesome entrance."
Jason frowned. He noticed the hog-tied Kirkopis.
"What the?"
"All by myself,"
Leo said.
"I'm special that way. How did you find me?"
The smoke, Jason managed. "And I heard popping noises. Were you having a gunfight in here?"
"Something like that."
Leo tossed him Piper's dagger, then kept rummaging through the bags of dwarf shinies. He remembered what Hazel had said about finding a treasure that would help them with the quest, but he wasn't sure what he was looking for. There were coins, gold nuggets, jewelry, paperclips, foil wrappers, cufflinks. He kept coming back to a couple of things that didn't seem to belong. One was an old bronze navigation device, like an astrolabe from a ship. It was badly damaged and seemed to be missing some pieces, but Leo still found it fascinating.
"Take it," Paselos offered. "Odysseus made it, you know. Take it and let us go."
"Odysseus?" Jason asked. "Like the Odysseus?"
"Yes!"
Paselos squeaked.
"Made it when he was an old man in Ithaca. One of his last inventions, and we stole it."
"How does it work?" Leo asked.
"Oh, it doesn't," Akmon said. "Something about a missing crystal?"
He glanced at his brother for help.
"My biggest what if," Paselos said. "Should have taken a crystal. That's what he kept muttering in his sleep the night we stole it."
Paselos shrugged.
"No idea what he meant, but the shiny is yours. Can we go now?"
Leo wasn't sure why he wanted the astrolabe. It was obviously broken, and he didn't get the sense that this was what Hecate meant for them to find. Still, he slipped it into one of his tool belt's magic pockets. He turned his attention to the other strange piece of loot, the leather-bound book. Its title was in gold leaf, in a language Leo couldn't understand, but nothing else about the book seemed shiny. He didn't figure the Kirkopis for big readers.
"What's this?"
He wagged it at the dwarfs, who were still teary-eyed from the smoke.
"Nothing," Akmon said. "Just a book. It had a pretty gold cover, so we took it from him."
"Him?"
Leo asked. Akmon and Paselos exchanged a nervous look.
"Minor god," Paselos said. "In Venice. Really, it's nothing."
"Venice." Jason frowned at Leo. "Isn't that where we're supposed to go next?"
"Yeah."
Leo examined the book. He couldn't read the text, but it had lots of illustrations. Scythes, different plants, a picture of the sun, a team of oxen pulling a cart. He didn't see how any of that was important, but if the book had been stolen from a minor god in Venice, the next place Hecate had told them to visit, then this had to be what they were looking for.
"Where exactly can we find this minor god?" Leo asked.
"No!"
Akmon shrieked.
"You can't take it back to him! If he finds out we stole it..."
"He'll destroy you," Jason guessed. "Which is what we'll do if you don't tell us, and we're a lot closer." He pressed the point of his sword against Akmon's furry throat.
"Okay, okay,"
the dwarf shrieked.
"La Casa Nera, Calle Franceria."
"Is that an address?"
Leo asked. The dwarves both nodded vigorously.
"Please don't tell him we stole it,"
Paselos begged.
"He isn't nice at all."
"Who is he?" Jason asked. "What god?"
I can't say,"
Paselos stammered.
"You'd better," Leo warned.
"No,"
Paselos said miserably.
"I mean, I really can't say. I can't pronounce it. It's too hard."
Akmon said.
Too many syllables."
They both burst into tears. Leo didn't know if the Kirkopis were telling them the truth, but it was hard to stay mad at weeping dwarfs, no matter how annoying and badly dressed they were. Jason lowered his sword. "What do you want to do with them, Leo? Send them to Tartarus?"
"Please, no,"
Akmon wailed.
It might take us weeks to come back. Assuming Gia even lets us.
Pasolos sniffled.
She controls the doors of death now. She'll be very cross with us.
Leo looked at the dwarfs. He'd fought lots of monsters before and never felt bad about dissolving them. But this was different. He had to admit he sort of admired these little guys. They played cool pranks and liked shiny things. Leo could relate. Besides, Percy and Annabeth were in Tartarus right now, hopefully still alive, trudging toward the Dwarves of Death. The idea of sending these twin monkey boys there to face the same nightmarish problem? Well, it didn't seem right. He imagined Gia laughing at his weakness. A demigod, too soft-hearted to kill monsters. He remembered his dream about Camp Half-Blood in ruins, Greek and Roman bodies littering the fields. He remembered Octavian speaking with the Earth Goddess's voice.
The Romans move east from New York. They advance on your camp, and nothing can slow them down.
Nothing can slow them down, Leo mused. I wonder...
What? Jason asked. Leo looked at the dwarfs.
I'll make you a deal.
Akmon's eyes lit up.
30%?
We'll leave you all your treasure, Leo said, except the stuff that belongs to us, and the astrolabe, and this book, which we'll take back to the dude in Venice.
But he'll destroy us,
Pasolos wailed.
We won't say where we got it, Leo promised, and we won't kill you. We'll let you go free.
Leo? Jason asked nervously. Akmon squealed with delight.
I knew you were as smart as Hercules. I will call you Black Bottom, the sequel.
Yeah, no thanks, Leo said. But in return for us sparing your lives, you have to do something for us. I'm going to send you somewhere to steal from some people, harass them, make life hard for them any way you can. You have to follow my directions exactly. You have to swear on the river Styx.
We swear,
Pasolos said.
Stealing from people is our specialty. I love harassment,
Akmon agreed.
Where are we going?
Leo grinned. Ever heard of New York? Chapter 13. Percy. Percy had taken his girlfriend on some romantic walks before. This wasn't one of them. They followed the river Phlegethon, stumbling over the glassy black terrain, jumping crevices and hiding behind rocks whenever the vampire girls slowed in front of them. It was tricky to stay far enough back to avoid getting spotted, but close enough to keep Kelly and her comrades in view through the dark, hazy air. The heat from the river baked Percy's skin. Every breath was like inhaling sulfur-scented fiberglass. When they needed a drink, the best they could do was sip some refreshing liquid fire. Yep. Percy definitely knew how to show a girl a good time. At least Annabeth's ankle seemed to have healed. She was hardly limping at all. Her various cuts and scrapes had faded. She'd tied her blonde hair back with a strip of denim torn from her pants leg, and in the fiery light of the river, her gray eyes flickered. Despite being beat up, sooty, and dressed like a homeless person, she looked great to Percy. So what if they were in Tartarus? So what if they stood a slim chance of surviving? He was so glad that they were together, he had the ridiculous urge to smile. Physically, Percy felt better too, though his clothes looked like he'd been through a hurricane of broken glass. He was thirsty, hungry, and scared out of his mind, though he wasn't going to tell Annabeth that. But he'd shaken off the hopeless cold of the river Cocytus. and as nasty as the fire water tasted, it seemed to keep him going. Time was impossible to judge. They trudged along, following the river as it cut through the harsh landscape. Fortunately, the Empusai weren't exactly speedwalkers. They shuffled on their mismatched bronze and donkey legs, hissing and fighting with each other, apparently in no hurry to reach the doors of death. Once, the demons sped up in excitement and swarmed something that looked like a beached carcass on the riverbank. Percy couldn't tell what it was. A fallen monster? An animal of some kind? The Empusai attacked it with relish. When the demons moved on, Percy and Annabeth reached the spot and found nothing left except a few splintered bones and glistening stains, drying in the heat of the river. Percy had no doubt the Empusai would devour demigods with the same gusto.
"Come on."
He led Annabeth gently away from the scene.
"We don't want to lose them."
As they walked, Percy thought about the first time he'd fought the Empusa Kelly at Good High School's freshman orientation, when he and Rachel Elizabeth Dare got trapped in the band hall. At the time, it seemed like a hopeless situation. Now, he'd give anything to have a problem that simple. At least he'd been in the mortal world then. Here, there was nowhere to run. Wow. When he started looking back on the war with Kronos as the good old days, that was sad. He kept hoping things would get better for Annabeth and him, but their lives just got more and more dangerous, as if the three fates were up there spinning their futures with barbed wire instead of thread, just to see how much two demigods could tolerate. After a few more miles, the Empusai disappeared over a ridge. When Percy and Annabeth caught up, they found themselves at the edge of another massive cliff. The river Phlegethon spilled over the side in jagged tiers of fiery waterfalls. The demon ladies were picking their way down the cliff, jumping from ledge to ledge like mountain goats. Percy's heart crept into his throat. Even if he and Annabeth reached the bottom of the cliff alive, they didn't have much to look forward to. The landscape below them was a bleak ash-gray plain bristling with black trees, like insect hair. The ground was pocketed with blisters. Every once in a while, a bubble would swell and burst, disgorging a monster-like larva from an egg. Suddenly, Percy wasn't hungry anymore. All the newly formed monsters were crawling and hobbling in the same direction, toward a bank of black fog that swallowed the horizon like a storm front. The Phlegethon flowed in the same direction till about halfway across the plain, where it met another river of black water. Maybe the Cocytus? The two floods combined in a steaming, boiling cataract and flowed on as one toward the black fog. The longer Percy looked into that storm of darkness, the less he wanted to go there. It could be hiding anything. An ocean, a bottomless pit, an army of monsters. But if the doors of death were in that direction, it was their only chance to get home. He peered over the edge of the cliff. "Wish we could fly," he muttered. Annabeth rubbed her arms.
"Remember Luke's winged shoes? I wonder if they're still down here somewhere."
Percy remembered. Those shoes had been cursed to drag their wearer into Tartarus. They'd almost taken his best friend, Grover.
"I'd settle for a hang glider." "Maybe not a good idea,"
Annabeth pointed. Above them, dark winged shapes spiraled in and out of the blood-red clouds.
"Furies?" Percy wondered.
"Or some other kind of demon," Annabeth said. "Tartarus has thousands."
"Including the kind that eats hang gliders," Percy guessed. "Okay, so we climb."
He couldn't see the Empusai below them anymore. They disappeared behind one of the ridges, but that didn't matter. It was clear where he and Annabeth needed to go.
Like all the maggot monsters crawling over the plains of Tartarus, they should head toward the dark horizon. Percy was just brimming with enthusiasm for that. Chapter 14.